Thy kingdom come. What God has done, He does, and He will do. I've learned over the years that is so true, brother. If we want to know about God, He gives us so much information in the Holy Scriptures about Himself. Sometimes it's indirectly, and sometimes you have to fill in the spaces, extrapolate, and of course, extrapolate correctly, because I try not to, when I extrapolate, I try to make sure that I'm extrapolating from a truth. If I'm just extrapolating from an idea, I shouldn't be extrapolating because that idea may be not true. But God has taught us that in the way He works, when you read the Bible. How does He handle situations? What has He done? And is still doing? We don't have that written down for us. We have to just see that. And then what will He be doing in the future? That's really valuable information, and we're going to talk about some of that today. Or I'm going to discuss that with you guys. About 90 years ago, the Church of God, then it was called originally, I think, the Radio Church of God, began this fellowship that most of us are from, not all of us, that most of us were called during that time. It started out almost 90 years ago. And an adage of the church from that very beginning, and it's always been, was the wonderful world tomorrow. That was the discussions, the messages were often, the publications, I think probably all of them use that adage, the wonderful world tomorrow. And it wasn't less and less until about the 80s, but that is quite true. The feast that we're celebrating today, brethren, and this week, the wonderful Feast of Tabernacles, is exactly, pardon me, that wonderful world tomorrow, when Jesus will have returned and established begun His thousand-year millennial rule. That is the wonderful world tomorrow. Now, we've had plenty of, the previous speakers have talked about the times leading up to that. Some of them are very serious. It's mostly when you realize, as I think, it's if we aren't at the end of the age within a reasonable length, I'll really be surprised, brethren, because when we read, we can read the apostles preaching all the time what will be happening at that time, and it's like reading our headlines in the newspapers today. So, and things are getting worse, aren't they? Are things getting better? I'm talking about in the world, in the society, in America. They're not. When I was a boy, things were so much, I'm talking about the world and America in general, not all the world. As an American, I often made the mistake of thinking that what was happening here is happening all over the world. Well, that was a serious mistake when I used to make that, because that's not necessarily true. We have Abraham's unconditional blessings, brethren, that he promised all of Abraham's descendants, regardless, and it's unconditional. So it kind of makes us wonder sometimes, well, things are so good. Well, it's not because we're so smart, or so better than other nations at all. I think in many ways, America and Britain and Western European Christian countries are. But the main reason they're better and things are better is because we have Abraham's wonderful blessing still, which were unconditional. So he still sends them. Oh, what was amazing when Mr. Armstrong began in the early ministers of the Church of God, talking about the world tomorrow, all Protestant professing Christian churches had no clue of what he was talking about. They didn't talk about it. I don't think they didn't see it in the Bible. Actually, many Jews don't see the actual meaning of this feast. We can know that because most Jews don't believe in Jesus Christ. So how are they going to believe that that the world tomorrow, this feast is a foretaste of? So the Jews know a lot still. I've known Jewish people that are very wise, and even in God's truth. But that's one thing. That's a major thing. If you don't believe in Jesus Christ, you lack a lot of knowledge. So, I have been privileged to know Jewish, wise Jewish people and religious people. They were very religious and in a good way, not in the way of 600 do's and don'ts. But the Protestant world was totally ignorant of that. So naturally they ridiculed us for even talking about it. And if you were there, you'd see. I would say that Mr. Armstrong was maybe one of the most unpopular people in America, because late at night you couldn't get him off your channel. I used to travel and I wanted some music and couldn't get it because but they were giving Mr. Armstrong's messages. Which was fine, and it led me to eventually be converted and become a Christian. So I'm very thankful for that. Let's see. The world tomorrow, it's after Jesus returns. But until then, we're living in that period of time. And this period of time, the world is in turmoil. I really think most of the world is in more turmoil than I've ever seen in my life. More trouble. Here in America, in spite of all of Abraham's blessings, we still have tremendous, we have so many troubles that they almost make us wonder, think for a minute about Abraham's blessings, because there's so many problems in every way, not just politically, of course, but in business and in the society, in the moral decline. Not that we were moral giants 50 or 60 or 70 years ago, but my mother was a fine Christian woman, and her teachings were right on line with anything I've learned since then. The one blind spot she had was about God's seventh-day Sabbath. But interestingly, before she died, she quit keeping Christmas. And also asked for me to bring a minister to anoint her for her sickness. And that's because I was doing nothing. When I did something and really told Mother about when I first, my beliefs, and, Mom, Christmas, I think I've read, Mom, that the Bible isn't biblical. Christmas is not biblical, Mom. She would not take lightly to that. And she told me, I was about 20 or 21 then, because I had been listening to the World Tomorrow broadcast for a year or two. And she looked at me, she said, Mom, she said, if you were younger, I'd have you committed. And because I didn't realize you don't do that. You're full of zeal, you learn these things, and you want to share with everybody, And, oh boy, do you. You drop the whole 9 yards on him. Well, that wasn't wise. So it took my mother a long time to get over that. So by me just shutting up about it and trying to live the proper example, which she could see. And my brother is an Episcopal priest. His son is an Episcopal priest. And when I told him that, you think he was really pleased with that information? He was not. If he wasn't my brother, I don't think he would have talked to me for a year or two. But even him, because being a wonderful big brother, he was always getting me out of jams. Bob was shoplifting Stanley, because he was my mother and father were divorced when I was very young, about 5 years old. So Stanley, my wonderful older brother, had to be kind of a surrogate dad. He was 5 years older. Mother had to depend on him, and he was very dependable. And so he was always bailing me out, trying to help me and try to keep what he could, not to distress my mom, because she had plenty of problems just providing for us. But you know, even after a few years, because I shut up about not doing those things, of dropping the whole information on him, period, immediately, about 10 or 15 years later, I had begun to straighten my life up. God was converting me and straightening my life up. And I think it was, in fact, I might have even been when I was converted, when I was about 26, when actually God, I was baptized with my sister and my wife, dear Barbara. We were all baptized together. He saw the change in my life, though, not what I was telling him that he didn't agree with. It didn't do me any good to tell him that. Really, it didn't. But what it did do good is for me to straighten out my life. And he told me that. It was very interesting. He didn't try to do this. He said, you know, Bob, I'm not on the same page with you, Bob. And he called it Armstrongism. He says, I'm not with Herbert Armstrong at all. He says, you know, Bob, but listen, please keep doing whatever you're doing. Because no longer was he having to bail me out of, you know, my problem, you know, relatively, I call them minor. I mean, they probably aren't minor, but all the very small troubles, relatively small troubles I was getting into. So the world, professing Christian world, has no clue about this holiday and its meaning. And is that important? Not realizing about Jesus Christ's return and the fact that he's going to set up his kingdom here on earth. They're not in line with that either. And that's all of professing Christianity that I know. So we have rare knowledge, brethren. We take it for granted, I'm sure. Over the years, you do. It's just human nature to take things that you absolutely know and you hear, and you hear about a lot and you're taught a lot. Naturally, to some degree, we all take things for granted, even good things like that. So that's what we're celebrating. And from this point on, I only want to share good news with you, brethren. In spite of all the lead up, things aren't going, the world isn't going to, the world is spiraling down. America is spiraling down. But there's still lots of good news, and that's I want to talk about. And most important, there's lots of very important good news, and that's what I want to share with you. I like to hear happy news. In fact, I don't like to watch a movie that ends sad. It can be a great movie, but it has a very sad ending. I don't want that. I want a happy ending, brethren. Don't you? So there's a lot of good movies. They're wonderful movies, and I watch them, but all of a sudden it turns sour and bad and sad. I don't want to watch that again. Because I want to watch a movie that will have realistic, of course, be realistic and talk about the problems of mankind even, and serious problems and be a very serious movie, but I want it to have, there's got to be good news, some good news, and that's the way I want to see my movies to end. And there are plenty of movies that way. So I don't replay a movie that has a bad, that sad offering, so a sad meaning at all, or ending. So it's the present situation of today has been very well covered by our previous speakers. I really couldn't add very much to it. Please turn to Matthew 24. I know that you are aware of this. I'm not going to be telling you much new information, brethren. But I've learned there's always something new to learn from the scriptures, even though we're very familiar with it. So Matthew 24, let's look at 21, that's what I have marked. No, let's start at 1. Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. I'm sure he had was probably already aware of it, but they were evidently very fabulous buildings, so that's what they wanted to do, even though he probably already had seen it and knew about it. And Jesus said to them, Do you not see all these things? Assuredly I say to you, not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down. Now that's a prophecy that happened about 70 years later with the destruction of Jerusalem. That did happen. So he didn't say that here, but little did they know, maybe at that time, probably didn't it exactly, because he didn't explain it here. Let's see. Now, his apostles asked a question that haven't you asked this question? I have. I have asked this question, and here's what it is. The apostles, now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Well, that's his time now. The end of the age, that's just before Jesus returns. So they want to know, what's going to be happening. And I always like to kid on a little levity. You know, Jesus says, I don't know. No, Jesus did not say that. He did know. And then he discussed some of these things. If you read down here, I'm not going to read it all. He talked about all these things that are going to be happening prior to that time. Wars, people say, false Christ, and Jesus told him to take heed to it. And so he was warning them to look for these things at that time, prior to the end of the age, before his coming. But here's a wonderful thing he tells them that we need to understand, and that's what I have this highlighted. He, after all, telling him about these wars, rumors of wars, nation fighting against nation, ethnic groups fighting each other, famines, pestilences, earthquakes, reading on down through verse 7 and 8, and then he says, all these are the beginnings of sorrows. But up in the middle, he has already told them, see that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. So, we're living that now, right? All these horrible things that are happening in the world, all the troubles of the world, I think are very definitely the signs of the end of the age, and we can get really upset when you read, if you only know the news, the newspapers, the TV programs, people that you've worked with or know, the average person in the society, there's no good news there. So you're going to be very negative about it. But Jesus says, when you see these things happening, see that you are not troubled, brethren. We do not, Jesus says that we do not need to be vexed by it. And why? Because as many people, many good Christians will always say, you know, God is in charge. Well, he is in charge. And he states that numerous times in Holy Scripture, that he is aware of what's going on. And even with nations, three or four major times in the Bible, Jesus tells the rulers of those major nations in history that he is the ruler of all nations. He sets them up and takes them up. Just because he doesn't, we don't see him working. But it's interesting, one of the speakers brought something that I've always missed. Why doesn't God come down? I really didn't clearly understand this question. Why doesn't God come down and reveal things personally to us, directly or indirectly? You know, he wouldn't show himself, but he did deal with the ancients indirectly, personally. And the speaker answered my question. Because, brethren, says he now reaches us, talks to us through Jesus Christ, his Son. That's why. Don't look for God the Father to be. He may. I mean, God will do whatever he chooses to do. But it's through Jesus Christ, his Son, that he now reveals himself and also his works. He reveals himself through his works, through the creation. And we do get, the New Testament gives us all kinds of messages from Jesus. Directly, as a person. He talked personally, face to face, and lived all of his life with his apostles and disciples. And when we read and study that, it's as if he's doing it to us. Because doesn't one of the apostles say that the Bible, the Holy Bible, Old and New Testament, was given, what's in the Bible, was given to the God's ministry or peoples, and written in the book of the Holy Bible also was given to us, that and on whom the end of the age will come. So all the things in the Bible, much of it's also for us. And the Apostle Paul taught that. And I'm sorry, it may not have been Paul, but one of the apostles, that was his mantra. These things are given, the things that he was teaching and the things the Bible teaches, were not just for them and for all humanity up till the end of the age, but they're for all of us right down to the end of the age, for us. So when we read the New Testament, brethren, whatever it's talking about, we need to personally take it as if it was given to us. Because it is. Jesus ends that part of Matthew 24 with a very, we will know the end of the age. When we see it, we will know it. And that's why I think we're in it, because these things have happened. He says, turn to 21. He says, and then at that time, there will be great tribulation such as not been seen since the beginning of the world until this time. And this part, brethren, it's why I know that I feel very much so, that we are in that period of time, however long it may be, and how long can it be? And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved alive. That's how. Now, you know, that really didn't exist until about, when did the atomic age begin? It began in the 20th century. So, up until that time, could you say that there was something that could destroy the whole, I'm talking about created by man, things that man created, wars, bombs, or whatever? I think it wasn't possible, mainly because prior to that time, there were places in the world that people didn't even know there were people. You think in the before the 20th century that the whole world was known, everywhere people were, they knew about and knew were there? No, probably not. But Jesus is saying the whole world will be affected. And no, it will be that serious. Things will happen that will destroy all human life from the face of it. Well, the atomic bomb is now I've read 100 times or 200 times or more than that, stronger than the ones that were used at Hiroshima or Nagasaki. Hundreds of times stronger than that. And the other nations have that too. I think there's 8 or 9 nations that knowingly or secretly have the atomic weapons. So that was one sign there for us, wasn't it? Man can now destroy all human life from the face of the earth. Before that, man did not have that capability. And I think God made that possible. Had God given them that ability, they would have already done it. Hundreds of years earlier, it would have already happened. And it didn't fit God's timetable. God has a timetable for the end of the age. But, and recently, compounding that's enough. Atomic warfare can destroy all life off the earth. But on top of that, we have, what do they call it? This thing that Elon Musk actually started. There you go. Artificial intelligence. Man is developing these, you might say, Frankenstein, non-human Frankenstein puppets, and can program them to an extent of where they cannot be controlled. And so they could be also, that developed, and you know, Mr. Musk has backed off that. He was gung-ho. I read in a recent article. And several of the people that began that and thought it was so wonderful, it was going to be great, they now realize, hey, this may be a Frankenstein monster, a monster that will turn on us and destroy us. We didn't even need that, but maybe that's a wake-up call for those that forgot that atomic warfare can do all life, end all life. So there's several points of good news. Jesus answered the apostles' question. What's going to happen to us? That's really what they wanted to know, isn't it? They want to know what's going to happen to them. Well, that's not wrong. It's human. They wanted to know what's going to happen to them. Well, we do too, you know, don't we? It's not wrong. What's going to happen to us, Lord? All this bad stuff's we know it's coming on. What is going to happen to us? Well, I think that God has answered that by either directly or indirectly, and that's what I'm going to discuss here for a few minutes. Oh, let's look at the group of people. God's chosen people are people God's worked with, Jews, and then Israelites, and then Christians. Please turn to Zechariah. I just learned this myself in recent years. Turn to Zechariah 12, please. Talking about the Jews. If you look around the world today, I think for the Jews, the nation that they call modern-day Israel, which is still mainly Jewish, or part or mostly. If you were a betting person, you look at the problem that the nation-state of Israel has and the Jewish people there, what chances would you give them if you were a betting person? Brethren, of course, we have more knowledge that God has given us than most people. But if you give that to the average person, they're surrounded by millions of people that hate them. And have told them, we want to get rid of you, and we're going to do it as soon as we can. They tell them that to their face. And then they try every which way to hurt them, to bomb them. And what's going on now has been going on for years. Not as bad. It's happening now worse than ever before to the Jews, the nation state of Israel. I wouldn't give them much chance, brother. But I've got good news for you. God does. God will save the Jews. And we're going to read that. Starting in verse 1 of chapter 12 of Zechariah. Who would know that this is in the Old Testament? The burden of the word of the Lord against Israel, thus saith the Lord, but we're not going to talk about Israel alone. This prophecy goes down to specify the Jews. But I want to read it anyway. Thus says the Lord, who stretches out the heavens, lays the foundation of the earth, and forms the spirit of man within him. Behold, I make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples when they lay siege against Judah. See, now God is talking about Judah, or he's talking about Israel, what we call the nation of Israel today. They're of Judah, mainly. And then I continue here, verse 3. And it shall happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem. I love God's personifications. I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all people. All who would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces. Though all nations of the earth are gathered against it, and brethren, not all nations of the earth are gathered against them today, but all the nations in the Middle East, with few exceptions, are gathered against them today. And eventually, before the return of Christ, the whole world will be against them as well. So, let's see. I will make Judah and Jerusalem a very heavy stone, and I like that, for all people who would heave it away, try to heave it away, will surely be cut in pieces, though all nations of the earth are gathered against it. And let's see here. And then in verse 5, see, we get down to this specifying. And the governors of Judah shall say in their heart, the inhabitants of Jerusalem are my strength, in the Lord of hosts their God. In that day I will make the governors of Judah like a fire pan in the woodpile, and like a fiery torch in the sheaves. They shall devour all the surrounding peoples, their enemies, I'm adding, on the right hand and on the left. But Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, Jerusalem. The Lord, go on in verse 7. The Lord will save the tents of Judah first, so that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem shall not become greater than that of Judah. In that day the Lord will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem. The one who is feeble among them in that day shall be like David, and the house of David shall be like God, like the angel of the Lord shall be before them. And it shall be in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem, or the Jews. So, brethren, that's great news, isn't it? Our brethren, the Jews, are not going to be destroyed. God is going to save them. He doesn't say he's going to save them because they're converted Christians or converted. Jews have a problem, don't they? I mentioned it before. Jews have a serious problem. They don't accept Jesus as their Savior. But anyway, in spite of all that, God has said that he's going to save Judah. He's going to save them later, spiritually. So isn't that great news about the Jews? I never saw that, brethren. I never saw that. Because I thought, you know, it looks like our Jewish brethren are going to be destroyed. And I always added, unless God intervenes. How about the Israelites? The ancient Israelites. Well, first of all, we need to understand one thing. I have a great article by our beloved pastor, Del Ledger. He wrote an article called "The Ancient Israelites." First of all, Del Ledger understood this. If we are Christians, then we are Israel. The Israelites aren't here today, the ancient Israelites, they died. But the people that they were, now has God has, in the New Testament era, and the Christian era, in Jesus Christ, God has, as Del mentions so succinctly here, if we are Christians, then we are from Israel. And mostly that's true. And even if you're, adopted? Well, God factors you in. Whether you're Jew or Greek, you will be factored into to God's people. And they are. And he mentions here specifically, as Christians, are we not the sons of Abraham? Galatians 3:7. I'm just going to give you these scriptures. Will state that. As Christians, are we Abraham's descendants and heirs to his promises? Well, Galatians 3 continues in 27 through 29. As Christians, are we children of the promise, the same as Isaac? Galatians deals with that in 4:28. As Christians, are we guaranteed the promise to all descendants of Abraham, whether they be by faith or by the law? Yes, Romans 4:16. As Christians, is there neither Jew nor Greek? That's what I mentioned. Not all are blood relatives of Israelites, but they are adopted and factored in. As Christians, there is neither Jew or Greek, but all are one in Christ Jesus, Galatians 3:28. And then lastly, the last one thing I'm going to mention here, as Christians, are we not fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God? And that's God's ancient people were exactly that too. Yes, we are. And of course, even in history, God saved the Israelites, didn't he? When he moved to destroy all of Egypt, which was the greatest nation of the world at that time, and he did so with 10 large plagues, he had how many millions? Between 4 and 6 million of them. In fact, they were getting so many, the Egyptians were leery about them, that they might go against them. But guess what? Did God destroyed all of Egypt. Just like God says it. Jesus, when he comes, prior to Jesus' return, the day of the Lord, there's going to be a lot of destruction of enemies. Well, there's a lot of God's people amongst the world and amongst those enemies. So is God going to save them? Well, what did he do? Remember what God has done, he does and will do. Well, what did he do here with Egypt? After the third curse, three curses were no picnic, but it's something that you could endure. But after that, he took them all away up to Goshen, completely out of where all the fireworks was going to happen and destruction of Egypt. He did save them from that. He moved to save ancient Israel. Because they were doing so great? No, they were not doing great. Even later in the wilderness, were they doing so great? No, they wanted to go back. They wanted to go back to slavery. And so God saved them, though, didn't he? God saved ancient Israel. In the midst of destroying the known world of that time. So God even did that then. Then later when they're in the wilderness, here he has, think of it, one man, Moses. What a guy. Do we really realize how awesome Moses was? God chose one man to head these millions of people who were like herding cats. But he was able to do it and did it. But then they started rebelling to the degree, I'm sure you know the story, where God said, look, Moses, this rebellious people, more or less, God says, I'm going to be rid of them, and I'm going to start all over with you, Moses. So that's how bad they got. They were just they were unfaithful, disobedient. Not all of them, but I mean in the main. And thanks be to Moses. If it wasn't for Moses, we wouldn't be here. Because Moses did something then. He said, please, Lord, please don't do that. And he prayed for God not to do that. Well, what happened? God answered that prayer. So God saved them, even though they were destined for destruction. God was going to do it. God was going to eliminate them. Now, a lot of people think that God's an old meanie because of that. That's because of they're ignorant, and I was ignorant of Bible fourth of my life. The reason we don't be troubled about God does a lot of things that people say. I've had people tell me, I don't want to read that Bible. Look at the people of the flood. He destroyed the whole earth, all the people except to have one family. Just wipe them off the face of the earth. They say, God, is that, they out of their ignorance, they think, isn't God horrible? Well, we can see where they're coming from, right? They're carnal. They have no knowledge. And that looks pretty bad. But what they don't know, God has the power of life and death. That's a big difference. Yeah, he did off those people for their own good at that time, because he even states, how many years? He sent Noah to preach for them 100 years. And even then, there weren't any that weren't totally sinful. So he kind of put them out of their misery. Just like if you have a loving dog that you love and he's sick and he's so miserable, you put him out of his misery. But we can't bring the dog back, though, so we're just sad. I lost my most favorite dog, and I don't want another dog. It's just too hard because he's not coming back. But God isn't in that position. God has the power of life as well as the death. And in the future, he has a plan for every one of those people that died in the Noahian flood. He has a plan for all the people that he dealt with at Nineveh and many other, Sodom and Gomorrah. And the Bible states that, and it's a wonderful study to see how God is going to rectify and restore all of that. All of the killing that he did, God will restore it all. And he has the power to do so. That's why God is not a meanie. That is, I understand why people have that idea, but it's out of ignorance, brethren, and that's just a fact. So that we've kind of talked about, but how about Christians today? We're in the middle of it. And if this is the end of the age, we're really going to be in the middle of it. When Jesus returns, the day of the Lord is going to be, it's going to be that awful time that worse than ever has been seen in history. Well, there's a lot of Christians. There are a lot of Christians, brother. I'm hopeful that there are millions of Christians. Maybe more than that. Well, is God going to wipe them off with it? Remember how God dealt with when Abraham was bargaining with him? And we learn from that how he wanted to, he asked God, God was going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And the patriarch said, oh, God, because Lot, he had some relatives there, and he didn't want them destroyed. He knew that Sodom and Gomorrah were evil, but he didn't want his family or his lot destroyed, so, and who would? You wouldn't want to see your family destroyed. So he had the character to ask God, probably in a proper way, God, if there are, he assumed there'd be 50 righteous in the land, will you destroy everyone? Well, there weren't 50. So it went all the way down to 10, and then I don't remember it even the 10. God said, I don't remember God saying, well, yeah, if there are 10, I'll do it. I'll save the whole sinful nation for that period of time, at least. Well, God did take the ones that were not. There weren't. See, it wasn't like America or the Western society, Western European Christians, and many Christians that lived and died. It wasn't that situation. There weren't 10, and the archaeologists had dug up remnants and studied those areas. Those were huge cities of hundreds of thousands of people because they were main centers of that part of the world. So, but God did save the few that were there. That was Lot and his family, or Abraham and his family, or Lot and his family, and wives and so forth. I think there were, I don't know, were there 8 or 10 of them? He did take them out and save them because Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed. But he took them out. So we see that God has done that in the past, that has saved his people from a sinful nation that is going to be destroyed. Sooner or later, God has saved whatever people that were what you might consider his people. Well, what my question is, with millions of people in America that are Christian, loyal Christians, I think we have probably hundreds of thousands of people over the years, maybe many more than that, of the Church of God made part of his family of God. And all over the world, probably in Western, probably all nations scattered. And the one reason that I'm quite sure of that God is going to save Christians, brethren. Now, there always have been, how many Christians have died for their faith? So, not all, I'm going to have to ask God, well, God, why did so many people have to die? Loyal, beautiful, wonderful Christian children. I have that question, and I know that God will be able to answer it. I'm not troubled, I'm not vexed by that, not knowing that. But I do know one thing that I'm going to close with, and that's what I have realized, understand what God is going to do. Because we want to know that. We would like to know that. Let's go back to Matthew 24. And the wonderful thing about this is Jesus telling us this as well, not just his apostles. In 22 of Matthew 24, Jesus says, unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Does Jesus mean for the elect's sake, he's going to shorten the days but then destroy them anyway? No, I think we can extrapolate that for the elect's sake, God is not going to destroy everyone at that time, bring the into the world onto everyone in all, because there's a lot of God's people out there, that he is going to somehow, some way, save them, and then Let's see. Holy Bible tells us that before the end of the world, before the day of the Lord, and it states the timeline in that section of the Bible you read, it's the time of the day of the Lord when Jesus is going to war against his enemies. And they're going to be destroyed just prior to his coming. He states that he is going to send out an angel to gather his elect from all the four corners of the earth. He states that. So this isn't saints that have been resurrected. These are human beings around the four corners. It refers four corners, so to speak, of the world. He sends an angel out to gather them up. And that, brethren, is great news for all Christian people. That God is going to, not all, some of us will die. Some of the Christian people are going to God for his purposes. They are going to die for their belief and faith in Jesus Christ. But in the main, that is not, God is going to save Christian people. He's going to save them. And so, brethren, I thought, what could be better news than that? There is better news in the sense that God is going to then resurrect all of his people to eternal life and take them into the kingdom of God that Jesus will establish when he returns. So I wanted to share that with you, and it was joyful for me to learn those things myself, because of my dear mother and many wonderful Christian people. And remember, did God save Abraham because of his righteousness? No, he did not. He saved Abraham in spite of the fact that he wasn't righteous. He saved him because of his faith and belief. That's why he saved him. So I have hopes that my dear mother, even though she didn't understand the Sabbath day, and many relatives and many friends, brethren and in family all my life, I that's good news for me that God is going to save them. And then deal with them according to their various personal situations.